Chachri Stoney. Hare Krishna, welcome again to our ever-continuing course on the Srimad Bhagavat Mahapurana science of the mind. Yesterday, I said that we were going to be looking at some excerpts from a book that was published in 1919, written by an Englishman named G.S.R. Mead. And the title of the book is The Doctrine of the Subtle Body in the Western Tradition. And I said that the reason we want to do this is because in these excerpts, some very essential principles are established that will help us build up our realization of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Realization. Srila Prabhupada wanted us to look at his books, as he said, from different angles of vision with the new lights. And this is one way to do it. That we can compare writings that apparently are completely out of the context of not only the Bhagavatam, but even the Vedas. This is coming from an Englishman, but he is a... he's deceased since long, but he was an expert in, shall we say, ancient esoteric doctrines. He wrote a lot in that area. And he also knew quite a bit about Indian scriptures and gives credit to them. And we'll read that. But what we find in reading these excerpts is that it is actually true, as Prabhupada says, that in the ancient world, there was really one prevailing science. There was really one prevailing outlook on what is real and what is not real, and that was the Vedic outlook. It appeared in different places, in different languages. There were different sages. We find Prabhupada mentioning at the gathering of sages on the bank of the Ganga when Maharaj Parikshit was preparing to depart this world, that learned persons from all over the world arrived there. And he mentioned the one sage, I think, Tritiya, whom Prabhupada suggests hailed from the western lands. So this Mr. Mead, in his book, The Doctrine of the Subtle Body in the Western Tradition, is quoting from ancient Greek sources. He's actually quoting from the original Greek text. You see in the footnotes the actual Greek script. It's not transliterated, it's the actual Greek, and then he gives his translation from many, many different books. So he had a very broad, as I said, that was his specialty, was writing works in this area. I read a couple other of his books. So I'm not reading this to lead you astray. I'm reading it actually to, as I said, to establish a foundation in which our realization and appreciation of the Srimad Bhagavatam may become stronger. Because it is very nice to know that in the ancient world, these teachings, which now seem to be to many, you know, people that you may meet and preach to, oh, you're a Hare Krishna, oh, you're the guys who believe in this and that. That's really wacko, man. How could you ever believe in weird stuff like that? But there was a time when any learned person in any civilized part of the world accepted the basic doctrines of Srimad Bhagavatam, the Vedic version, as being the science of the age. So without further ado, let's begin. So this is a quote. And as I told you, this was written in 1919. That's almost 100 years ago. So the language is a bit, by modern standards, we should say cumbersome. So I do make effort to sort of render it into an easier text. But let's, anyway, try to pay attention to what Mr. Mead writes here, that the astral or sidereal religion of antiquity revolved around the central notion of an intimate correspondence between man's psychical and sensible apparatus, or his inner embodiment, and the subtle nature of the universe. The ground conviction of astral religion held that there was a subtle organon of great nature, an interior economy of the world soul. Man's nature was, so to say, an excerpt from this greater nature, and it was conceived of as a germ or seed, as it were, of the universal tree of life. Man was the microcosm of the macrocosm. On page 8, Mr. Mead noted that in India, this doctrine of an intimate correspondence between man's psychical and sensible apparatus and the subtle nature of the universe reached its most mature expression. He said that in India, this doctrine reached its highest stage of development. So, you know, even if you paid attention to that, it is likely that you found this rather obscure. So his style of writing harks back to that Victorian area that we were talking about yesterday, I think. So I'm going to now try to make it plainer. So let us see what he means by the subtle nature of the universe. So I'll start with Mr. Mead's term, world soul. There is a term we find cited by Srila Prabhupada in the Bhagavad Gita, from Vedic scripture, and this term is Vishvatma, which means the soul of the universe. This is the name of Sri Vishnu, the super soul. Srila Prabhupada writes that in the Vedic hymns it is said, Patim Vishvashyat Meshvaram. Therefore, the Lord of the living entities is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu. That's from his purport to Bhagavad Gita 3.10. In the same purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, Prajapati is Lord Vishnu, and he is the Lord of all living creatures, all worlds, and all beauties, and the protector of everyone. Krishna tells Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita 3.15, the Supersoul is the original source of all senses, yet he is without senses. He is unattached, although he is the maintainer of all living beings. He transcends the modes of nature, and at the same time, he is the master of all the modes of material nature. For the purpose of creation, the Supersoul invests his son, Brahma, born from the lotus of his navel, with the fiery spiritual essence that foments the Rajoguna. You can find this in the Brahma Sangita, chapter 5, verse 62. It's explained that the tejas, the effulgent energy that the Lord transfers to Brahma, is the root source of the Rajoguna, the mode of passion. Thus, Brahmaji, though not a direct Vishnu Tattva expansion of the Lord, also acts as the world soul. In Vedic literatures, he too is addressed as Prajapati. But unlike Sri Vishnu, Brahma is himself possessed of material senses, even as he bestows material senses on other creatures. Brahma tends to become attached to his work of creation, while the Lord himself is never attached. Brahma is not beyond the modes of nature, for he is the Rajoguna avatar of the Supersoul. That is why Brahma was unable to answer the questions of his sons. So, quoting from a purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 11.13.18, the followers of Srila Prabhupada state, this is very interesting for your information, that Srila Jiva Goswami has quoted three verses from the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam as follows. In the ninth chapter, verse 32, Lord Krishna blesses Brahma with realized knowledge of the Lord's actual form, qualities, and activities. In the ninth chapter, verse 37, the Lord ordered Brahma to rigidly carry out the Lord's instructions and affirmed that Brahma would thus never be bewildered in his cosmic decision-making. In the 6th chapter, verse 34, Lord Brahma assured his son Narada, O Narada, because I have caught hold of the Lord's feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, with great zeal, whatever I say has never been proved to have been false, nor is the progress of my mind ever deterred, nor are my senses ever degraded by temporary attachment to matter. In the present verse, in this 13th chapter of the 11th canto, Lord Krishna states that Brahma unfortunately did become bewildered by his creative functions, thus providing a grave lesson to all of the Lord's empowered representatives. Although one may be elevated to an exalted position in the Lord's transcendental service, at any moment there is danger of false pride polluting one's devotional mentality. So in despite of these previous assurances that Brahma got, and even the assurances that he gave to his own son Narada, we find in the 11th canto, 13th chapter, Brahma again becoming bewildered by the question of his other sons, the four Kumaras. And that was because he is the creator. So he's created this universe, so his mind is involved in it, in attachment. And his sons are asking him about how the mind can become pulled away from the senses, how we can push the senses away from our minds. And thinking about this, Brahma became stymied. His own intelligence just locked up, and he couldn't answer. So continuing, we're talking about Mr. Mead. That was just a way of explaining this term, the world soul, and reminding us again of what's going on in this part of the Bhagavatam that we're now discussing, Canto 11, chapter 13. So Mr. Mead wrote of the astral or sidereal religion of antiquity. So the words astral and sidereal refer to the patterns of stars and planets we see arrayed in the night sky. Now this is a quotation from Srimad Bhagavatam 5.23.4. This great machine consisting of the stars and planets, states Srila Sukadeva Goswami, resembles the form of a Shishumar, or dolphin, in the water. It is sometimes considered an incarnation of Krishna, Vasudeva. Great yogis meditate upon Vasudeva in this form because it is actually visible. So this is one of the things we find in studying the ancient world, even outside of India, that there was such a conception of a world soul and the entire universe being a form of God. And that actually the planets, the heavenly, just like, it's interesting how in, you find in ancient English language, in olden times in England, they referred to the Milky Way, you know, that stream of stars in the sky, as the cow's path. So the conception was that there are cows up there. And we know there are Surabhi cows in heaven, Kamadhenu, heavenly cows. And they are expansions of the original Surabhi cows in Goloka Vrindavan. Because in the Govardhan pastime at the end, Lord Indra came, king of heaven, along with Surabhi of heaven, who presented herself before Krishna as, actually, I am originally one of your cows, but now in this lifetime I am acting as the heavenly Kamadhenu. So we find, I have an interesting book called, I just received it, it's called History in English, written by this same Owen Barfield that Nitai Gauranga quoted before. So he's also going back in time, in language. And you see how the use of language becomes much more beautiful, much more poetic, and also much more spiritual. And yet nowadays we think that our civilization, our understanding of the world, is the crown of creation. I remember a quote of one contemporary author. He said, "What could any man today say to an ancient Greek that would surprise him? Nothing." You see, because again, as this A.N. Whitehead, this British philosopher not so long ago said, All Western philosophy is simply footnotes to Plato. It was Plato who lived in 500 BC, who laid down the basic ideas of philosophy that are still with us today. We haven't advanced beyond them. And Plato was just picking up the leavings of, he admitted, just like I mentioned Hesiod, who is in what we call recorded history. He's the first ancient Greek poet. But he was referring to earlier poets and earlier scriptures and lamenting that because I'm born in the Iron Age, therefore I have no access to them. They're gone. How condemned it is to be born in this age. So all I've got is these little crumbs of what they left. And I'm trying to pass that on. And that is his work called the Theogony, which means the creation of the gods. And there you get terms, you get concepts like chaos. We have today this word chaos, which means, you know, when everything becomes very confused. But actually in its original sense of the word in the Greek, ancient Greek language, chaos is a synonym for pradan. Pradan means the unmanifest material elements. So this is very sophisticated philosophy, you see. And we still use the words today, but, you know, it's like you walk into someone's bedroom and it's all, you know, scattered, and you say, what a chaos, you see. We use the words like that in very mundane fashion today. But when one traces, this is the thing that this Owen Barfield is right, you take the words of today, just like, here's an example. The word bottom. So the Indo-Aryan, or the Indo-European root of the word bottom is bud, from which we get buddhi. And today, the only resonance of that meaning that I know of in the English language is the phrase, well, we've got to get to the bottom of this. It means we've got to understand this, you see. Now we use bottom in so many ways, which we don't even want to mention or suggest. It's taken a whole other connotation. But actually, bottom, bot, this comes from bud, buddhi, which means to understand. And so there's so many words that we use every day. The original meaning has been lost or scattered or, you know, covered over. But if you trace back, it's just like you trace the English language back, go back to Beowulf days. I read somewhere that they're going to make a movie of this ancient, it's supposedly the first known work written in English. And it's actually older than any writing in any other European language that's known of, back to something like 700 years after Christ. Beowulf, and it's just an adventure of a hero who goes battle some kind of monster named Grendel. But the language of Beowulf, none of you would be able to read. It's Old English, extremely sophisticated, multiple cases, genders, you know, male, female, neuter, many eight cases, compound words, you know, and extremely sophisticated. And yet we feel ourselves so superior to those people. Oh, they were just practically savages. They didn't know about cars and airplanes. But they were speaking on a level, you know, we're going, hey man, what's going on? And slapping hands and things, you know. This is the way we communicate now. And they were talking in this very extremely, so who is more intelligent? You can tell by language. And language is the expression of intelligence. So these people were much more, they were writing and with such alliteration, such, you know, the words they were using had so many resonances, many shades of meaning, multiple meanings at one time. Just like in Sanskrit is the perfection of that. The Sanskrit word, you look in the Sanskrit English dictionary, Monier Williams, you see one word will have many, many meanings, sometimes opposite of each other. And poets, Sanskrit poets, would take advantage of that. And so one line of poetry could have four or five meanings, depending on how you read it, you see. So that's real intelligence, you know. So in the ancient times, anyway, these concepts were there that Mr. Mead is talking about, that the universe was a representation of the Supreme Being. Mr. Mead used the term subtle organon of great nature. This means that the subtle principles of the cosmos are comparable to the organs of a living body. That's the sense of the term organon. As we see in Bhagavad Gita 13.3 purport, there are three principles fundamental to reality. Bhoktya, the individual jiva souls, bhogyam, matter, and predita, the controller of both. On the cosmic scale of manifestation, bhoktya, bhogyam, and predita are the triune, or trividham, this is the term used, trividham, of number one, four-headed Brahma, who leads all the other jivas in creation, two, the virat, or the elemental universe, and three, Lord Vishnu himself. In our own body, we find countless microscopic cells, which Srila Prabhupada confirmed, are each animated by an individual jiva. He was asked that, and he, at least, as I recall, it's in the Veda base, Prabhupada said, there's nothing wrong with that. He was asked if it was so, that every jiva has, every cell in the body has its own jiva in residence, and Prabhupada said, there is nothing wrong with that. So, out of all these jivas, we ourselves, we who are conscious of the whole body and the world beyond, we ourselves are the one individual soul chosen by the Lord to execute the mission that He has ordained for this body. The body is an organon of the elements of great nature. These elements are classed in two categories, the gross, earth, water, fire, air, ether, and the subtle, mind, intelligence, and false ego. The localized Paramatma dwelling in the core of the heart is the Antaryami, the inner controller. So this is very simple, actually, what I've taken from Gita. If I got into Narada Pancharatra, I'd be talking about the four levels of the self. And, the Vedic scriptures, what I'm giving you is a simplified version. Vedic scriptures, you can go really, really, really into this. But this is just chapter one. Mr. Mead stated that there is an interior economy of the world soul. Now here, the word economy is not to be understood in the way we use it today as the management of national wealth or something like that. Rather, there's a theological sense to the word economy. You can find it in a good dictionary. And so the theological usage is God's management of His creation. That means that, at least in old theological texts, they would use the word economy in that way. The way that God runs His universe. Thus, the universe functions as a vast organic system, as a single living entity of tremendous proportions, which is called the Virat Rupa, the universal form. Man's nature, according to Mr. Mead, is a germ or seed of the universal tree of life. In Srimad Bhagavatam 3, 8, 15, and its purport, we learn that the lotus flower upon which Brahma appeared is the Virat or universal form of the Lord. This is what I mean. I mentioned this before. You know, everyone talks about how to understand the fifth canto. Well, I got news for you. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are at least a half a dozen presentations of the universal form. And they're different from one another. So, once you've solved the fifth canto problem, now you can go on to the Padmasana of Brahma problem. And you can put those two together, those two. And then you can bring in Lord Vamadeva's universal form and the Mahapurusha in the 12th canto and Sudarshana Chakra as the universe in the 9th canto and Lakshmi Narayan combined together in the 6th canto. You can figure all these out and then you can make a Vedic planetarium. But everyone just talks about the 5th canto. Well, we got news for you. So, where were we? Yes, the source of the Virat, or this lotus form of the universe, is the subtle Hiranyagarbha, a feature of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, who is glorified in the Vedic hymns as having thousands of heads, eyes, and feet. See Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya 20.292. He is the master of the universe, the Trimurti of Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu, who attend to the universe's three modes of nature are his secondary expansions. See TLC chapter 8. Merged within Hiranyagarbha are countless individual souls who, like so many seeds, await germination. See Brahma Samhita 5.22. Within the lotus stem sprouted from his navel are 14 planetary systems. See Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi 5.103. Brahma appears within the center of the blossoming petals of that lotus as the creative force of Hiranyagarbha. He brings forth the seed-like jivas from the body of the Lord, physically embodies them and positions them within suitable planets according to their karma. Thus, Srimad Bhagavatam 7.14.36 states, quote, "The entire universe, which is full of living entities, is like a tree whose root is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Achyuta Krishna. Therefore, simply by worshipping Lord Krishna, one can worship all living entities." So you see, the same analogy is used. That Mead is quoting from ancient sages of the West, talking about the universe as a great tree and the human being as a seed or germ of that tree. And there's a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam which says exactly the same thing. So therefore, in the ancient world, they definitely were more intelligent than us now. Mr. Mead concluded, "Man was the microcosm of the macrocosm. Hence the mind and senses of mankind, what Mr. Mead calls his psychical and sensible apparatus, are tiny reproductions of the cosmic form of Prajapati. The perceptions, thoughts, desires, and activities of an individual person are related to the entire universe in a most intimate and subtle manner. Srimad Bhagavatam 11.28.60 informs us, Jivo antar atma guna karma murti sutram mahan iti urudvena gitaha, that the individual living entity's qualities, activities, and forms are bonded to the original form of material nature by sutra tattva, a fundamental tie." That's how it's quoted. But if I can just expand a little bit, if you look in the Sanskrit dictionary, sutra means thread, can mean thread, just like this Pavitra Sutra, the Brahman thread that men wear, is also a sutra. Or it can also mean a code. It means a long text that's been compressed into something very simple. A very simple, in computer jargon, they say string of text. You see, if you notice that, if you use computers, search this string. It means a string of words, a very simple string. So that's another sense of it. And tattva means reality. So what this verse is saying is that there is a thread or a code that ties our gross and subtle bodies to the whole universe, the gross and subtle manifestation of the entire universe. And in Brahma Samhita chapter 5, 21 and 22, you can find more insight into this. And also in Srimad Bhagavatam 5, 17, 22, 23, there's a term sutra yantrita. So there's also more about the tie of the jiva to the whole universe. So this tie is actually personal. For example, here's an example. Prabhupada points out that the cogitations of intelligent human beings on questions of cosmology, that means the thoughts that scientists today have about what the universe is, what our relation to it is, and the questions of the duality of mind and matter, they are, on a deep level, stimulated by the world soul Brahma's thoughts on the same issues. Because Prabhupada says that when Brahma found himself in the beginning on the open lotus petal, there he was, and he started looking around the darkness, and that way he grew four heads. So first he was a pratyakshavadi. He was relying on his senses to understand his situation. And then he started, therefore, climbing down the stem of the lotus. And then he climbed down until it says he reached the edge of time. Reached the edge of time. Now, our Nimai Gore has just finished the Sudarshan, Mahasudarshan Jnana Yajna, and he will remember in the Sudarshan Yantra that six-pointed star around the heart, the bindu of the yantra, which has a which is inscribed with mantras, which can be interpreted in a Goloka way by the Hamsas, in a Vaikuntha way, and also in a very dark way by those in the mode of ignorance, as the Kala Chakra, the wheel of time, in which the goddess Tamasi lives in darkness, a very fierce form of goddess Kali. And she is called Kali because she is the consort of Kala, who is time himself, a form of Lord Shiva. So Brahma reached the edge of time. In other words, he reached that place where the Kala Chakra is spinning, which is full of darkness and danger and the screams of tormented souls who are being cut into shreds. It's spinning just like a saw. And he could go no farther. And that is the Sudarshan weapon held in the hand of Vishnu. So he could go no farther than that. He reached the edge of time. So what a concept. What an amazing concept. And he could not go beyond. No one can go beyond time, you see. We'd like to. I've often thought, wouldn't it be great to have control over time so that, you know, you could speed up your movements so that they would be impossible to see. You could move from here to the temple just like that. No one would even see you. Suddenly you're there, just standing in front of the deity. You see, everyone else would seem to be frozen. You see, because you're moving on a much faster time scale. Wouldn't it be fun? But we're not able to. We're not the controllers of time. Only Krishna is, because he is Chakri. He holds the wheel of time in his hand. So when Brahma reached the edge of that wheel, he could go no farther. And then he heard the words tapa, tapa. Or in Brahma Sangiti, he heard the simultaneously, because you cannot understand the Gopal Gayatri or Kama Gayatri without tapa, without sense control. So he was initiated by the divine Saraswati. That means the Saraswati in the spiritual realm, not the material goddess Saraswati, who sometimes said to be the wife of Lord Vishnu, and she's expanded as the wife of Brahma too. But from the transcendental Saraswati, the goddess of transcendental knowledge, he was initiated into the Kama Gayatri and also given the instructions, perform austerity, perform austerity. And so then he gave up his Pratyakshavad and Anumanavad, his attempt to understand things through mind and senses, and went up to the lotus and there sat down for the length of one of his days, which is 4,300,000,000 years. He sat in deep meditation upon these transcendental sounds that he received, and then got the darshan of the Lord and received the four nutshell verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. Also in the Pancharatra we find that in five of his nights, after that he was given further instruction. That's why the Pancharatra is called Pancharatra, because Pancharatra literally means five nights. Narada Pancharatra means that Brahma was instructed by the Supreme Lord in five of his nights, the equivalent to period of 4 billion, 800 million years, times five. He was given instructions into Narada Pancharatra is, most of the Pancharatras teach about worship of Lakshmi Narayan, but Narada Pancharatras are about worship of Radha and Krishna. And Radha and Krishna very clearly stated in Narada Pancharatra to be the supreme original personalities of Godhead from whom Lakshmi Narayan are expanded. And so this was instructed in secret at night, in five nights, by the Lord to Brahma. So, in this way, Brahma became a devotee of the Lord. But Prabhupada points out in when he's discussing Brahma's looking in four directions and then climbing down and finally reaching the edge of time, that there he was going through the same process that modern scientists use. So this is what I mean. On a deep fundamental level, whatever we're doing with our minds is related to the cosmic mind of Brahma and ultimately to the metacosmic mind of Vishnu, Lord Mahavishnu. Metacosmic means even beyond the cosmos, you see. Meta, like when you say meta language, it's a language about a language. Like we can talk about Sanskrit in English. So Sanskrit is the language we're talking about, and English is the meta language we are discussing Sanskrit in. And then we could go up higher to a meta-meta language. We could talk about English, the discussion of Sanskrit in the English language, say in Bulgarian, you see. And then we could go up to the meta-meta-meta level, you know, by talking about Sanskrit in English, in Bulgarian, in another language, you see. So this way you go. So the Lord is actually meta, 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 meta. But Garbhadaksha Vishnu means he's the meta cosmic mind. Brahma is the cosmic mind, and Garbhadaksha Vishnu is the meta cosmic mind, and Mahavishnu is the meta, meta cosmic mind, and Vasudev, Lord Vasudev, from whom these Purusha avatars emanate, is the meta, 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 meta. And in this way, you can go back all the way to Krishna, who is just achincha, inconceivable. That's where it all stops, in inconceivability. So I hope I write here, dear listener, that the scientific and philosophical evidence presented in the preceding pages has not sidetracked you from the main path of this essay. I do not intend here to delve into the structure of the macrocosmic mind and its recapitulation. Recapitulation means it's sort of reduplication on another scale, a smaller scale. Recapitulation in microcosmic human psychology. But we will, if we can get to the next chapter in the time, because we also have our edge of time, our own edge of time that we have to deal with. So I'm just hoping we can get through the second chapter, then we will actually go into that. It's very, very interesting. Particularly the relationship of the sense objects and the mind, and how attachment flows honey-like out of this relationship to glue the attention of the soul to this material world. If spiritual liberation entails freeing the mind from its attachment to sense objects, how do we cut apart the baffling complementarity that renders the term mind meaningless in the absence of a relation to sense objects? And likewise, renders the term sense objects meaningless if there is no relation to mind. A similar question is asked by Srila Prabhupada in his purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 8.5.43, quote, "The body is a small universe, and since we cannot understand how things are happening in this small universe, how can we understand the affairs of the bigger universe?" End of quote. What we call the body is really a state of relation between two bodies, the physical and the mental. You see, this is why it's so hard to understand what's going on in this body, because there's actually two bodies. Mm-hmm. Like Prabhupada said, we wear overclothes and underclothes. The overclothes everyone can see, the underclothes we don't want anyone to see. It's just like that with the mind. You know, we're all very glad that people can't see our minds, because that would be really shocking. You know, we'd be really constantly with a red face and downcast eyes all the time if people could actually see our mind. Just like if suddenly some strong wind came and blew all our overclothes off and we're just sitting here in our underwear, we'd all be really embarrassed, you know. So in the same way, we're all glad that we have this gross material covering hiding our minds from everyone else. And because we're so attached to this covering, therefore it's very difficult. It's impossible for us to understand, as Prabhupada says, even the small universe of the local body. Because there are actually two bodies. There's a mental body. Yeah, we're aware of the mental body, but it's so much enmeshed in the affairs of the gross body and in the perceptions of the gross body that we lose the thread. We just use this term sutra, thread. So there is a thread that ties the gross and subtle body together. The mystics talk about the silver thread, you might have heard, you know, in astral traveling. But that thread goes, it's not just connecting these two bodies, it's ultimately connecting us with Brahma and with Garbhodakshay Vishnu and Mahavishnu and Vasudev and Mahanarayan and the original Vasudev in Dwarka, and then Lord Balaram, who was Krishna's first expansion, and then the original personality of Godhead, Shamsundar Sri Krishna. So there is a thread that connects us all to Krishna. You see? And we've lost that thread a long time ago. And because we've lost that thread, we can't connect things. Our perspective, our association, by association I mean mental association, you know, just like that's going on all the time. Like we associate this with a word, shoe, you see, this form, you know. And this is one of the things that really stymies those people who say consciousness will one day be reproduced by computers. This is one of the big stumbling blocks of artificial intelligence. To get a computer to recognize something as simple as this. You can get it, okay, after a lot of programming, you know, for many, many months and years, you can get it to recognize this as a shoe. But then you turn it this way, does not compute. Then you have to program this, you know, so this takes years, you know, to get, then computer finally relates it to a shoe. Okay, what's a shoe for? Computer says, I don't know. Well, a shoe is to be worn on a foot. What's a foot? Then you start the same thing again. You know, you show the bottom, here's a foot. Okay, then you show the foot straight on. What's that? That's a foot too. Oh, really? So that is a major hurdle for, you know, people speak so breezily about how computers will one day, you know, become conscious, but sorry folks, you know, that ship is not going to come in at any time soon. Or as they like to say in the south of the USA, that dog don't hunt. So, yes, similarly, the universe as a whole is a vast exhibition of relations between subtle minds and gross sense objects. Brahma, the creator of the physical cosmic manifestation, was unable to draw a line of demarcation between the inward mental process of visualizing the objects that our senses inform the mind about and the outward reality of these objects. His problem of discrimination was on the cosmic scale. Ours is on the local scale. We are met with the bafflement of the intellect in both cases. So now we have about 27 minutes, and if our Nitai Gauranga is feeling like Popeye, who just popped the lid off of a can of spinach and threw it down his throat, and then boing, he's feeling all ready to go, he's going to tell us a bit more about the problems of sense perception and the relation of the senses to the mind and so on from the Western perspective, if there is a Western perspective.
There is.
There is. Great. Now we're going to hear about that perspective.
Quite that good, but
I was just trying to encourage you. That's part of my job around here.
Thank you. Okay, so today is part two of the wild world of sense perception, as my section of the class is called right now. And I guess we're going to start, this is going to be boring as anything, but it's somewhat necessary. We're going to talk about the anatomy of the eye quickly. I'll make it painless, I promise. So, the human eye looks something like this. And you got that thing there, and then you got here.
So, how the human eye works is like this. There is an image here. We have a candle, let's say. The image of the candle comes in. This is the cornea. This is the lens of the eye. The iris, which gives the eye color, is around here. In between here is what's called aqueous humor. It's a thin liquid that is between the cornea and the lens. In here is called vitreous humor. It's a thicker, kind of hair gelish type of substance.
Hair gelish?
Hair gelish.
I think you better explain that term. You know, English is not the first language of some people. It's like, I think even people who speak English will wonder what you're saying.
What
it means like gel you put in your hair, you see?
Does everyone know what, does anyone not know what hair gel is? Oh, no.
You know, guys who comb their hair to look real cool, you know, they want a nice slick back. It shines in the neon lights of nightclubs at night. So they use this grill cream and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Gunk it into there. It's like motor oil, you know, in the hair. This is called hair gel. So you're saying inside the eye there's something of about that quality of substance.
So we have that
thick
there.
And slimy and...
Slimy oil. And thick and gooey and...
Gooey and...
Yeah.
Yucky.
Another good way. And then back here is the retina, which has the... photoreceptors, that is the cells that pick up and register different wavelengths of light.
So we have the image goes in like this, process here, and the image is presented upside down on the retina. Now, here, around here, is an area called the fovea, which is mostly, of photoreceptors, there's two types. There's what's called rods, and then there's cones.
So rods of the, however...
Rods are shaped like a piece of chalk in your hand.
Like this. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of the photoreceptors are rods, and those are only to pick up... They don't respond to color, but only dark and light, so...
Those are mostly situated here, and then here in the fovea is mostly
cones, and there are three types. We can say small, medium, and large, and between those three, those are what register color. So our our perception of color is responsible from everything in here, and they're kind of sparsely thrown at around here. So we have this candle here in the external world, and then it's represented here on the retina back here. Now, where was I going with this? Okay, I remember. Okay, now if I can give you another view. No, I can do it like this, actually. So, the photoreceptors, the things that are receiving the light, are all the way in the way back of the eye. Now, from the photoreceptors comes other cells called bipolar cells, which connect two photoreceptors or 100 photoreceptors or 1,000 photoreceptors together. And then in front, this is going to make a point, I promise.
This is interesting. Then from there is other cells that connect to these called ganglion cells. So there's these cells coming here. And then there's also blood vessels that are giving nourishment to the photoreceptors, to the rods and cones, and then all these cells, these ganglion cells, come together and come into a thick thing that comes through here, and there's a big hole right here, big hole right here, and this is called the optic nerve. So all these are connecting here, going into the optic nerve, going out of the eye,
into the brain,
like that.
So now, the interesting part is this, and I will give a neat handout that will illustrate this point. If maybe you could just kind of pass these around, pass them back, and everyone can get one. I'll give you one too. So bear with me. I know this is boring, but this will get interesting. I promise.
It's not boring.
Not boring.
You have low self-esteem.
Right? I have low self-esteem, and I think it's boring. So. Does everyone have one? Almost? Is there enough for everyone? There's one. Is there enough? Okay, so this is what you do. You need to close your right eye, and on the top part of the page there is this black dot and a black cross mark there. So close your right eye, focus on the little X or the plus sign or whatever you want to call it. Focus on that and move the page back and forth slowly.
Back and forth.
Back and forth, very slowly. Focusing on the little crosshair. And then at one point you'll see that the black dot disappears. Did everyone get that? Okay. Anyone have any idea why that black dot disappears? Except for Govindu Kung, because I already talked to him about this. Anyone?
They join.
What joins?
They join.
Oh, on the bottom one, you mean? Yeah. Do you have any idea why, though? Yes.
Because naturally we have, in our field of vision, we have blind spot.
Okay. Okay, so this is where it gets neat. So this here, there's a hole where all these nerves go out of the eye. So there's a big hole. There's no photoreceptors here. If you were to look at it from the front view, it would look, here's the eye, here's the fovea, and all the photoreceptors are here. Right around here somewhere, there's just a big gaping hole where there is no photoreceptors. So... So realistically, if we shut one eye, there, in theory, would be a black dot where we just don't perceive anything. So we look around, there's a black dot everywhere, in theory. But the interesting thing is we don't see it. We see it in a case like this, but what's happening in a case like this is the black dot, we see it because it's not in the blind spot. When it goes into the blind spot, our mind creates what's supposed to be there. So it just figures, well, there's a big white area here, and so, you know, that's this area that's in the blind spot, that must also be white. So when we close one eye, we're creating a certain part of our reality. It's, you know, this dot right around here. So everywhere we look, we're creating it. We've made it up in our mind. It's actually not perceivable by us. It's one small spot, when one eye is closed at least. And further, realistically, we should see If our vision was an exact representation of the external world, we would also see a number of bipolar cells and ganglion cells and blood vessels, but we don't see them. So realistically, we would look out here and we'd see squiggly lines and it would be a big, huge mess. But we don't see that. We see a nice, solid, beautiful, picturesque scene. And that's because our mind is also... improvised with that. It is said, well, I think it's going to look, because, you know,
it's
you
running
look around,
Photoshop.
It's running Photoshop. It's cleaning things up. It's making everything look nice, everything look understandable. And so the point of all that is that, you know, for a number of reasons, we can say that our experience of the world is not a true experience, but it's a representation. It's something that we can say of the world, but it's not necessarily directly the world. And so this is what the point that's being made in this verse, that Lord Brahma can't understand the line of can't draw a line of demarcation between the external world and our perception of the world. Because actually our perception of the world, our understanding, everything that we're seeing here is a projection that's in the back of our brain, in the visual cortex. And so what's out there, we don't really know. We have an idea, we can make a guess, But in essence, it could be something greater than we understand. So another way to show that is this. So we have, as I said before, we have three types of cones. This is what precedes color. So we have short cones, medium cones, and large cones. Now what these perceive is this. Our eyes can detect electromagnetic energy, what we refer to as light, can perceive that it comes in waves. So we can perceive anywhere between 380 nanometers to 760 nanometers means this. So you measure from the top of one wave to the next, and that's, you know, X nanometers. And then another wave is longer, and that's a different one. So this is what color is. Color is this. When, let's take, for example, what we refer to as red. Red is a longer wavelength of light. Red is, let's say, 760 or 740 nanometers. So that's a longer wave of light. And of the cones, the red one is the smaller one. And then this would be around green, and this would be violet. So when this longer wave of light comes into the eye, this cone is picking it up and reacting very strongly. So this cone is saying, oh, this is, I like this a whole bunch. This cone is saying, you know, it's okay. And then this cone is saying, it's not doing anything for me. So when these three cones combine, and they're telling the brain, oh, I like this a lot. Well, I thought it was okay. Well, I didn't really like it at all. So then the brain understands that it's affecting mostly this one. So this must have a longer wavelength of light. So this must be what we call red. Where was I going with that one? Okay. So human beings generally have three types of cones. But then there are people who are, quote, colorblind. And one type of color blindness is that they don't have, let's say, this cone. They only have this one and this one. So their perception of color is different. They don't have the perceptual system to appreciate the full array of colors. And so what if something is, let's say, purple, they'll perceive it as blue, let's say, but they won't be able to appreciate the full spectrum of colors. So in that sense, here's something interesting. So in that sense, I think we would dare to say that people who have two types of cones cannot appreciate or cannot have an accurate representation of the world. They can't see purple. So there's purple out there. We know it because I think most of us probably have all three sets of cones. So we can see purple, but then there's these other people who can't see purple. So we would say that we have a fuller understanding of reality, or we appreciate the fullness of reality because we can see purple. Now, here's something interesting. There is a genetic defect, or maybe genetic enhancement is a better word, and I think it only happens in women, that they have a mutated type of cone, which kind of is a little screwy and kind of is in between. So really they have four types of cones. And so the ones who have four types of cones, they can perceive more colors than people with three types of cones, which is probably everyone in this room, most likely. So for example, someone can hold up, let's pretend these are blue, just play along with me, two different blue things, and people with three types of cones like myself will look at it and say, no, they're exactly the same. The person with four types of cones can see, no, that's a different shade of blue than that one. This one is brighter. That one it's richer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So actually, then the person with four types of cones has a deeper and more full understanding of the world. So then all of a sudden, we're handicapped. We don't have a full appreciation of reality. And further, there are some animals, and for some reason, the only one I can remember is like this one type of shrimp. and I don't know why they have it, but they do. They have seven types of cones. So, these shrimp, which are, you know, these basic, you know, somewhat, you know, prehistoric looking animals, have seven types of cones. They can perceive colors that we cannot even conceive of. So actually, there are certain types of shrimp that have a better understanding of the external world than we humans do. Kind of funny, isn't it? Let's see. Okay, I have a fun thing here on my computer again. If everyone can, move forward, we'll have a.
Come on. Don't miss the fun.
Okay, we have this neat figure here. We have this, everyone can see, green cylinder on a black and white checkerboard. Now, I want someone to make a comment about this square here and this square here. Can anyone make a relationship comment about these two? The color of them.
One's black and one's white.
Okay, one is black and one's white. That's precisely the answer I was looking for. Would everyone agree with that?
No,
I wouldn't.
What would you say?
Both gray.
Hmm? They're both gray.
Yeah.
Different shades
of gray. What would you say?
I'd say they're exactly the same.
You would say they're exactly the same. I think Maharaj is going to be the one to win here. So we do question one here. So there they are there. We're talking about these two things here. And lo and behold, they are the same damn color, even though they don't look it at all when you take this yellow thing away. And we can do the same with, I think it's this square here, and I can't remember what we'll do it just for kicks. These two here look different, but actually the same color. So the idea there is that even though these two squares are giving the same, there's the same frequency of light coming into our eye, and we're registering it the same way, we understand that this is of the white squares and this is of the black squares. And to make order of it, to give an understanding of it, and our cognition of it, what we make of our perceptions is different. Maharaj won, and he saw through the whole illusion.
I should get a
prize for you. That was really good. But you ruined my whole fun time. I was going to blow everyone's mind. It didn't work. Okay, so that's all I have for the computer. Oh wait, is it? Okay. So here is where it gets even more fun and interesting. So what we refer to as color, we call the plants and the trees, all that green. What green is green is actually wavelength of light of about 550 nanometers. So green is an electromagnetic energy that's at a certain wavelength. And when that electromagnetic energy hits, especially this type of cone here, it changes it, it transposes it. It actually translates it in a sense. It translates this type of energy into neural electric energy. So this is taking this, perceiving the light, perceiving the electromagnetic energy, actually what we refer to as light, and changing into neuroelectric energy, putting that into the brain, and the brain is saying, okay, this is green. But actually, realistically speaking, all it is is a frequency of light or a frequency of energy. And scientifically speaking, we can say there's no real reason why we should make the assumption that type of light emanates from something that's actually green. I think what most people in the science of perception would say is that green is something that we've created to to interface with a reality that's greater than we can understand. That our seeing something as green is a way of us understanding that this is different. This has a different quality to it than something that emanates a lower frequency of light and therefore we call red. So there's a theory, an interesting theory called inverted spectrum theory. Inverted spectrum theory, I'm sorry, this is thick and probably boring. Inverted spectrum theory states that green and red, for example, because they're on opposite sides of the spectrum, can actually be purely created by our minds. For example, I can be seeing these plants here as green, and someone else, let's say Mr. Govindakund, can be seeing them as what we all commonly know as red. But when I was a little boy, I asked my mom, "Mommy, what color is that?" And she said, "That's green." Because it's one color, it's an objective thing. And Govindakund was asking his mom, "Mom, what color is that?" And she said, well, she said in whatever language you speak there in that country, but she said, that's green. But he's seeing it as red. But his whole life, he's calling what's red green, 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 green. So when I say, "Govindakund, what color is that?" He says, "It's green." I say, "Yeah, it's green, isn't it?" But our experience of that color can be entirely different. I mean, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that argument because I'm a theist and we think that Krishna is blue and we think that there's an objective type of blue, etc., etc. But if nothing else, it's interesting to say that our entire reality can be very different from someone else's reality. But because it's an objective, that we're talking about an objective thing, that we would refer to it with the same words, use the same vernacular to talk about it, but we could be perceiving it as very different. I think I can stop there.
Okay.
Which leaves 4 minutes.
I have something to add.
Oh, good.
There's something else just to be learned from just the, what he has, in the most general sense, presented. A lesson about science, Western science, that it is visual oriented.
We have this term, seeing is believing. And you can say science is pretty much based upon that principle. So, science always leads with the eyes. And therefore, the Western scientific view of the world is so much different from the Vedic, which leads with the ears. And we read about all the, you know, we read the Shastra and all these amazing things that we can't understand because we're so visually oriented. So I want to just give two, in the little time we got left, two examples. I don't know if I mentioned one. I don't know if I mentioned sorry, because I did talk about it recently. One was about an anthropologist. Did I talk about the anthropologist who went to South Africa, to South America in this class?
No.
No, okay. So there was an anthropologist who went to South America, deep in the jungle, Amazons. And he found a tribe, he was not found, but he heard about this tribe where very few white men had ever met these people. So these people, they lived in, say, you know, pristine, unspoiled, their primitive, original culture. And he wanted to firsthand experience what it's like to be these people. He wanted to live among them as they do and sort of share their consciousness. And so he discovered that because they live in this dense jungle, eyesight takes a back seat to hearing. It's just the way their subtle body is wired, so to speak. Because with the eyes in the middle of a jungle, you don't see much. You just see a bunch of greenery around you. So he was amazed that he could be sitting there with some villagers they would hear, they would stop, and they would hear something. All he could hear would, wind and rustling of leaves, just general sounds. But they would stop and listen, and then they would say, this jaguar, there's this South American, it's actually bigger than a leopard, quite a large cat, jungle cat. There's a jaguar out there, and they would say, in their terms of distance, how far out it was, and that it's just jumped, it's been walking through the forest and it's just jumped into a tree and is waiting in the tree for some, eatable prey to come underneath, and it will jump down on it. And, all he could see was leaves and what he could hear was just general jungle sounds, but they had such a cute sense of hearing that they were perceiving hundreds of yards into the jungle all around, everything that was happening. And he would go out sometimes and investigate and find out that it was true. He would then see with his eyes that there's some monkeys over here, or there's a three-toed sloth hanging, out there. He would go and look, and he'd see it was exactly what they said. And they're just sitting in their village, and through hearing, they had such a range of experience, far, far beyond the eyes. And then there's another example I want to give is of a famous musician. There was an Oscar-winning film made about him recently, Ray Charles. I grew up listening to Ray Charles, the man. So, Ray Charles was blind. And Ray Charles had such an acute, because he was a musician, so he was very tuned in to sound vibration. Blind people, it's well known that they compensate for their loss of vision by having exceptional sense of hearing. But he was exceptionally exceptional because he was a musician. So he once was sitting in a house, and the window was open, and he was talking with someone inside the house, and this person was saying, "How do you do it? You're blind, but you play this music, and you're so tuned into the world. I mean, you're dealing with people," because he was very clever. He would act like a country bumpkin, but he could figure people out real quick. And they would be trying to cheat him, but he would turn the tables on them. And he was doing this all through the sense of hearing. He could hear the quality of the voice. He could tell if someone was lying to him or not. And so he was asked. He was sitting in a house in a suburban neighborhood with a open window and a garden outside, and birds out there twittering, the usual cars driving by, the usual sounds we hear. And he's sitting there, blind person in his glass. "So how do you do it?" And he said, "Well, how does that hummingbird out there do it? How does it hover? The hummingbird, this bird that goes from flower to flower, its wings are beating so fast you can't see them. It's a little bird. It almost looks like a big bug. So how does that hummingbird do it?" And the person looked, and sure enough, out there in the garden, there was a hummingbird. Now, you can't hear a hummingbird's wings. You see, even if you get up real close to it, because its wings are moving so fast. It's like the wings of an insect, moving. And he's sitting inside a house, and the hummingbird's out in the garden. There's all kinds of sound, and he could hear the humming. He knew it was there because he could hear its wings. And he said when he was playing piano, he would smoke. So he'd have an ashtray on the piano above the keyboard. And as he was playing in between the notes, he could hear the sound of the smoke of the cigarette. He was so tuned in. Now we're talking about a person born in Kali Yuga, like you and me, more or less. But his because he was a genius. He was, Frank Sinatra once said, there's only one genius in this business, and that's Ray Charles. So he was a genius. And so he had, his mind was so much focused on the sense of hearing to compensate for his lack of sight, that he could hear things that are just impossible for human beings to hear. Now again, referring back to the Vedic culture. The Vedic culture was based on the science of sound. And it's said in Kali Yuga, we don't have Brahmins who can chant the Vedic mantras in